There is an incredible amount of critical illness.
This type of ECMO or VV ECMO really doesn't provide much.
We're going to reproduce that cardiac output for them.
Pulmonary failure without possibility of transplant, it's not going to be worth it.
This is by far one of the most challenging aspects of placing someone on ECMO.
The VA ECMO is the way to go.
Welcome back to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Mike Winters here from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore. Happy New Year to all of you out there listening to CCPEM. This is our first podcast of 2019. Very excited for this year. We have a tremendous amount of great content coming for you over the next several weeks, over the next several months. In addition, we are continuing to revamp our website to provide you with a much better user experience in terms of listening to the podcast. A ton of new features coming. But before we get to those and before we get to the topic for this week's podcast, let me introduce and turn to my three fabulous co-stars here on CCPEM, Dr. Peter W., Dr. Rob Rodriguez, and Dr. John Greenwood. Peter, how was your New Year's?
Great New Year's in New Orleans. Spectacular weather. Everything still is mild here, so it's delightful. Great Sugar Bowl and some interesting time. So happy New Year's to our listeners.
Outstanding. Rob, how was your New Year's on the West Coast?
It was nice. We also had pretty decent weather and typical New Year's Eve kind of trauma cases. And it was, year started off well.
Outstanding. And John, how did you ring in the New Year in Philly?
Well, I was fortunately in the emergency department, I suppose, for New Year's Eve, which we had a wonderful shift. It was busy, lots of great patients, and a little bit of fun as well. And I was actually the evening shift, so I was able to make it home. And I actually walked in the door at 11:59 and was able to cheer on the ball drop with two kids that were still up. So it was a good way to bring in 2019.
That sounds great. And I hope that all of you listening got to ring in the new year with those that matter most to you. Well, what is going to be our first topic here in 2019? I don't know about you guys, but certainly over the last several weeks, it just seems like a tremendous amount of sick people are presenting to our emergency departments. Perhaps it might be just the time of year, but there is an incredible amount of critical illness that we've been treating and managing over the last several weeks. Principal among those can be folks that have come in with respiratory failure, especially in light of influenza season. And then we've had a number of patients, cardiac arrest, and just in general, cardiac failure. The University of Maryland is a complex cardiology specialty hospital. It's one of our primary service lines, so we get a lot of complex cardiac patients. And in the emergency department, I think we're just used to managing patients who come in with acute respiratory distress, frankly, respiratory failure along with cardiac failure. And we've got a number of modalities to help manage those patients. From the respiratory standpoint, high-flow nasal cannula, non-invasive ventilation. We've talked a lot about rapid sequence intubation and then mechanical ventilation if those therapies fail. And on the cardiac failure side, well, we've got a few things as well, but primarily limited to pharmacologic therapy. So management of these patients with vasoactive agents until they go up to the intensive care unit. But the question arises, well, what happens when these therapies that we're used to and very familiar with providing to critically ill patients, what happens when they don't work? And that brings us to our topic here to kick off 2019, and that is extracorporeal life support, ECLS. It's also referred to as ECMO, and then in the setting of cardiac arrest, ECPR. And there's an outstanding article that was just published right here at the end of 2018 in Resuscitation. Lead author was Swole, but you'll also recognize a lot of other names on that article, namely Joe Belezzo, Zach Shiner, Scott Weingart. And the article is titled Extracorporeal Life Support in the Emergency Department, a Narrative Review for the Emergency Physician. This is an outstanding reference. We will certainly list it in the handout for this podcast. And we're really going to use that article to launch into several discussion points about the use of ECLS in our EDs. Now, in terms of recommendations, in 2015, the European Resuscitation Guidelines did recognize ECPR for patients, primarily as rescue therapy for refractory out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. In terms of the AHA here in the U.S., well, they're a little bit more cautious regarding recommending ECPR, just given the overall paucity of data. But more and more publications are coming out each year highlighting the use of ECLS for a variety of conditions. John, before we get into those indications, those conditions, and even contraindications, kind of lay the background for us and just kind of give us an overall description of what we're talking about here when I use the letters ECLS.
Okay, Mike. So I think as we're talking about the types of ECMO that are available, there's two main types to talk about. So VA ECMO, which is primarily aimed at replacing circulatory support for patients who are largely in cardiac failure, can also provide oxygenation as well as CO2 removal. And typically with veno-arterial ECMO, blood is drained out of the femoral vein and put through a machine where it provides basically a motor that spins the blood through the oxygenator and then is returned, usually when it's percutaneous placed, through the femoral artery itself. We call this kind of retrograde blood flow because the blood's actually returned up the aorta as opposed to down antegrade like the heart normally does. Now, this is a little bit different than VA ECMO is what's delivered to kids. So in kids, you might see a IJ or a carotid cannulation strategy, but mostly in adults, we're doing percutaneous delivery through a femoral vein and femoral artery cannulas. Some other nice things, particularly for VA ECMO, is that for patients who present in cardiac arrest, so the worst type of circulatory failure, we can also provide some temperature control. So we can easily titrate our targeted temperature management through the ECMO circuit itself. With VA ECMO, you can provide up to about 10 liters of blood flow. So you can pretty much replace all the blood flow that's normally pumped by the heart in patients with pretty bad advanced heart disease. So the other type that's maybe providing support a little bit different from VA ECMO is veno-venous ECMO. And basically, this is the same exact circuit, except the cannulation strategy is just a little bit different. So blood's drained from the femoral vein that comes out of the IVC. It's then put through the circuit again, which basically runs through the motor, through the oxygenator where gas exchange happens, and return back to the patient through an internal jugular vein. So this type of ECMO or VV ECMO really doesn't provide much in terms of blood pressure or cardiac support. It's really just designed to provide extrinsic, basically, gas exchange for patients with bad lung disease. And oftentimes these are acute reversible diseases. So think about things like ARDS, bad pneumonia, things like that. So basically providing primary pulmonary support as opposed to cardiac support. And for VV ECMO, you can still provide fairly high levels of flow. So 6 to 8 liters per minute of flow will oftentimes give you adequate oxygenation for patients with really bad pulmonary failure or respiratory failure. Now, in certain circumstances, people may hear of like a hybrid strategy where it's VAV or veno-arterial venous ECMO. This gets a little bit more complex, and usually this is for patients who have bad heart and lung failure, and you need extra flow to oxygenate the blood in addition to provide circulatory support. But to be honest, for the most part, most patients will start out on one modality, usually VA or VV ECMO primarily, and then things may change once they get to the ICU. But for the most part, as an emergency physician, the only thing I'm concerned about is where I'm going to start. And that's basically determining whether or not the patient has pure respiratory failure or has pretty significant circulatory failure, which they would go on VA ECMO.
Outstanding, John. That really helps set the stage for what we're about to discuss. Now, for those of you, as John was talking, trying to picture in your mind where these cannulas are, the article that we referenced at the beginning and are using for this podcast discussion, they've got some great illustrations in that article on cannula placement locations, and it can really help to put things in perspective as you're listening to this podcast. So we'll certainly will be linking to that article in our handout. Now, Peter, many years ago, probably most people have heard about ECPR. It's fairly commonly discussed, albeit a very complex procedure. But over the last several years, there's been a number of articles that have talked about ECMO or ECLS use in other conditions. So what are some of the current indications? What type of patients would we be thinking about instituting ECMO or ECLS in?
And so this is great because I think John set us up great, Mike, in regards to talking about the arterial end of things, VA, ECMO, really focusing on those patients with primary cardiac disease, and the veno-veno ECMO, really focusing on those with pulmonary disease. So again, when we talk about VA ECMO, this is refractory cardiac arrest. Those patients who, despite our resuscitative measures, really can't make it over the hump. And so we're going to reproduce that cardiac output for them. Those patients who may have frank cardiogenic shock for unknown etiologies, those people with massive PE and evidencing shock. So those people who may be either refractory to lytics or who may have lytics that are severely contraindicated for the patient. So we would place them on VA ECMO. Those overdoses, most predominantly either a beta blocker or calcium channel blockers that are associated with severe cardiogenic shock, those patients would benefit. Severe cases of hypothermia and the really cardiac depressant effects of severe hypothermia, this can buy you time as we rewarm. And then refractory arrhythmias or dysrhythmias or profound electrolyte disturbances, most notably hyperkalemia. And then lastly, we know that about 50% of septic shock patients have frank cardiogenic shock. So those people with severe sepsis and associated cardiomyopathy, they would benefit from the VA ECMO. And we would compare that, just like kind of note that all of those are linked to limited cardiac output. And so that's why the VA ECMO is the way to go. When we talk about veno-veno ECMO, I want you to think about those trauma cases that have severe pulmonary contusions and we need to buy time as the lung heals. ARDS that John had mentioned before. And I want you to think about, particularly now that we're in severe flu season, thinking about ARDS associated with flu. Near drowning cases, those cases with fat or amniotic fluid embolisms, air embolism, major airway injury or obstruction, and then profound anaphylaxis with an inability to ventilate the patient. You might even think about it with severe asthma and inability to ventilate the patient as well. But those would be the patients who benefit from veno-veno. Again, those people with a primary lung disease, and you just need to buy time while the lung heals.
I think that's outstanding, Peter. And we've used VA ECMO. We do have a ECMO program in our emergency department. We've certainly used it in the setting of ECPR or refractory cardiac arrest. We've done it for a few cases of hypothermia along with massive PE, but some of those other indications are really novel and certainly worth remembering, especially sepsis-related severe cardiomyopathy, the refractory arrhythmia is very interesting in terms of those indications. And then especially in terms of the VV, what you just mentioned, even profound anaphylaxis, that's something that's probably not at the forefront of what we're thinking, but those patients with epinephrine refractory anaphylaxis and they're having hypoxemia and inability to ventilate. So great job on those indications. Well, having said the indications, I'm guessing there's probably contraindications. Rob, take us through, I guess, the set of patients where they're critically ill, but they're probably just not good candidates for ECLS.
Yeah, Mike, there are a few contraindications to ECLS, and those mainly have to do with irreversible type brain injury or other sort of long-term non-survivable conditions. And so the first of those that are thought to be irreversible brain injury are unwitnessed cardiac arrest, in which a patient has an unknown downtime and is not awake, prolonged transport or prolonged interval without CPR. Again, that's getting at the fact that these patients are going to likely have anoxic injury and not survivable. Other signs of severe irreversible brain injury, other conditions associated with that would be contraindications. And then there are conditions like advanced malignancy with limited life expectancy, other end-stage cardiac or pulmonary failure without the possibility of transplant, because this, again, is a modality that you have to have a consideration as a bridge to something else. So in those patients who had advanced malignancy or end-stage cardiac disease or pulmonary failure without possibility of transplant, it's not going to be worth it to invest this type of intervention on. And then finally, some have proposed that advanced age is a contraindication to this, but there really is no definite age cutoff number that we use.
Agreed. Now, it would be up to each institution to decide amongst the multi-specialty, say ECMO or ECLS team, what age, if any, you're going to use. I do know that some centers do have a hard line in terms of their age, but as you indicated, Rob, it is a relative contraindication, and each case would be considered individually. Now, John, let me turn back to you, and we may not necessarily need to get into too many specifics on this, but there are some important things. We kind of understand what it is, the type of patient or the indications for it, making sure they lack the contraindications, but now getting down to actually instituting this therapy, a lot of it begins with the cannulation, and there's probably some pearls in there on cannulation that we'd want to know about. What are those?
No, absolutely, Mike. And just as with any technology, just as when we put patients on a ventilator, we have to intubate the patient. And just as with intubation, how technically challenging that can be, the same is true for cannulation or the vascular access required to put someone on ECMO. And it can be overly simplified to say that, oh, it's just a bunch of Seldinger technique dilations, because this is by far one of the most challenging aspects of placing someone on ECMO, particularly in the ED. And a lot of this has to do with largely how unstable, particularly in the emergency department, patients can be. And when we're talking about VA ECMO, these patients are often on high-dose pressors, vasoactives, if they're in a progressive cardiac failure, or in worst cases, actually in cardiac arrest. And we all know how technically challenging it can be to do any procedure on a patient who's actively getting CPR. And particularly with VA ECMO for ECLS for cardiac arrest, one of the most important things that's really fundamental in terms of ensuring that this patient has the best chances to survive is really standing back as a team leader, and while the multidisciplinary team is placing the patient on ECMO, really focusing on the basics and making sure that that patient's getting high quality CPR during the cannulation. And at University of Pennsylvania, we're fortunate we actually use mechanical CPR for our eCPR patients. And without getting too far into it, I can tell you that that really makes a significant change in terms of some of the technical challenges that can arise while placing someone on ECMO. And really, there's kind of two approaches that, whether it's an intensivist, a surgeon, or in some places, ED physicians will take when cannulating patients. And I think the most common one is percutaneous anymore. The technology has gone a long way that we're now able to put these large vessel cannulas in with ultrasound percutaneously. In some circumstances, when it's a complex cannulation or the patient has some anatomical challenges, a cut-down technique may be implored if the clinician feels more comfortable with that. When I was at Maryland as a fellow, we still did a lot of cut down, and I'm sure that's probably changed. Now, I think a lot of places have moved on to percutaneous technique, and there's just a couple of reasons for that, that it's become more preferred. I think it's relatively quick. We can do it within 10 to 20 minutes or so, depending on how challenging the dilations are. But what's nice is the bleeding complications are fairly minimal. These patients are often anticoagulated, so bleeding is always a concern on ECMO. There's no need for vessel ligation. In general, infection rates are pretty low because there's not a gaping incision that these cannulas are going through. And what's nice is, particularly as we've got more savvy with ultrasound, you can use ultrasound to locate the vessels pretty quickly. Now, it's important, particularly if you're doing arterial cannulations for VA ECMO, just to remember that, well, we're talking about 15 French tubes going into a common femoral artery, it's important early on to make sure that you have good distal limb perfusion if you're going to the common femoral artery, check in pulses, and oftentimes we'll probably empirically bin a 7 French reperfusion cannula to the SFA just to make sure you're getting good blood flow to the ipsilateral leg that femoral artery cannula is going in. I can tell you, if you get leg ischemia or a dead leg on ECMO, it's really hard for that patient to survive that complication. And certainly the choice of size of cannula kind of depends on the indication. So for our VA ECMOs, for ECPRs, we're usually doing a 15 French arterial, a 17 French drainage cannula in the femoral vein. But in bad ARDS patients where you need a lot of flow, when you need 6 liters of flow to oxygenate the patient, we've gone even up to 29 French, 31 French venous drainage cannulas to run through the circuit. But after cannulation, the circuits are going to be an important piece of equipment to take a look at and to understand. hopefully, if you're at an ECLS center or an ECMO center, I'm sure there's perfusionists that are orienting the team and things to look out for, potential complications with the oxygenators, as well as some of the blood damage that can happen. But they're going to be the ones that are generally priming the circuit, or at least helping the team learn how to do this on their own. And this is usually primed with crystalloid. In some cases, they may prime the circuit with blood. Some places even use colloid like albumin. But again, these perfusionist specialists are really, really helpful in kind of bringing the patient and managing the technology. In some cases, at least at our place, the University of Pennsylvania, we have perfusionists available 24 hours, but we also have very skilled nursing teams that manage our ECMO circuits. So this is going to be a little bit variable depending on where you work or where you refer to, but it's nice to have that backup, particularly as you're trying to worry about the patient, let alone the technology, can get pretty complex pretty fast.
That's outstanding, John. Tons of pearls in what you just said. You talked about bleeding with heparin, so I think it's worth just mentioning as well. Don't be surprised when your ECLS team administers heparin to these patients. Certainly with foreign bodies, these cannulas, the potential for thrombosis, patients will be receiving heparin, and they're going to be following that fairly tightly with APTT levels, or you could also follow ACT levels. And there are goals for those that we don't necessarily need to delve into or mention here. Just know that these patients are typically going to get a fair amount of anticoagulation. Usually that's with unfractionated heparin and initial dose, say, of 100 units per kilogram. And that can certainly cause bleeding. And Peter, I'm sure there's a whole host of other complications that are probably worth hearing about in terms of our patients who are going on ECMO or ECLS. What are those?
Yeah, so just fairly quickly, it makes good sense if we break it down this way. There's the cannulation-related complications that can occur. So clearly, these are big access points with big catheters, so major vessel perforation. Accessing these vessels can create pseudoaneurysm. If we go through posteriorly, you can have associated retroperitoneal hemorrhage. And then if we cause hematoma formation, we can actually have distal limb ischemia, and that can also be tossing embolic events as well. From a circuit problem, we have hemolysis. There can be, again, inadequate drainage within the circuit. And then the malfunction of either the oxygenator, the thing that's driving oxygen to the blood, or the pump itself. When we talk about hemorrhage and hemorrhages that the patient can experience while under this care, intracranial hemorrhage, retroperitoneal, which we already mentioned, GI hemorrhage can occur, pulmonary hemorrhage, as well as really bleeding at the site, the cannula site itself. And then lastly, just the catch-all, thromboembolism, which we mentioned before with the limb ischemia, both can occur arterial as well as venous, hypoperfusion, and then left ventricular distension, which causes an associated pulmonary edema. And then lastly is anytime we're accessing these sites, particularly when we're going to femoral sites, the risk of infection is real. And so you can have catheter-related bloodstream infections, which can complicate these procedures.
Outstanding, Peter. John, let me ask you, Peter mentioned in terms of circuit-related inadequate drainage and then under hemorrhage, pulmonary hemorrhage. Maybe could you explain a little bit about, just say, the failure to offload that LV and progressive distension creating pulmonary edema? Is that where the hemorrhage is coming from?
So in patients with real bad heart disease, and particularly if you have a poorly functioning left ventricle, one of the things you have to be careful about, particularly in the first hour or two when patients are put on VA ECMO, is that one, that they should get an echo right away, because you want to make sure that that aortic valve is opening. Because remember, this blood that you're putting in peripherally is going the opposite way of what it normally goes, and it creates a pressure head somewhere in the proximal aorta. And if the blood that's still going through the heart isn't getting ejected out the left ventricle, it can back up pretty quickly. And the patient can rapidly present with massive pulmonary edema, pink frothy sputum, and in some cases, frank hemorrhage. So an early echocardiogram is indicated for any patient who's emergently put on VA ECMO for advanced heart failure or cardiac arrest, because if there's any signs of one, aortic insufficiency, so let's just say that aortic valve's just sitting wide open and all that blood is being pushed back in the left ventricle, or that the left ventricle isn't ejecting any blood, that can be a major problem. And if it's not ejecting blood, the patient needs to go to the OR pretty quickly for some form of LV vent. And more often than not, I think a lot of institutions now have moved to placing a temporary Impella device to provide some antegrade support to offload that sick and injured left ventricle.
Very, very helpful. Well, let's kind of wrap up with one last discussion point. Rob, I'm going to turn back to you. We've talked about a lot of specifics, indications, contraindications, the cannulation, but I don't think any of this can happen without a well-functioning team. So maybe say a few words about just the ECLS team.
Yeah, Mike, these are high-intensity interventions that have to be implemented quickly. So organization of the ECLS team is paramount. You really have to have this structured and organized ahead of time to make this happen. And the composition of the team really depends on the site and the available resources. But in general, the team members should include cardiac surgery, vascular surgery staff, obviously emergency medicine when that's occurring in the ED, emergency nursing, perfusionists, and really pretty much anybody who's going to be involved in intensive care with this type of patient. The key is really that policies have to really be established ahead of time. And these should include the indications, the times that you're going to use it, the contraindications, the overall protocol in terms of clinical management, troubleshooting when things go wrong, transport both to the center and within the hospital itself from the ED perhaps to the ICU or to the OR. You also have to have, obviously, policies regarding equipment maintenance, as well as ongoing follow-up of patients who have this intervention implemented. And all staff members really should be trained in emergency procedures in the event of something like a sudden circuit failure or hemorrhage or other complications that can occur with this. So again, this is really a big team effort, and you have to have policies and protocols set ahead of time to make this happen.
Peter and John, any other comments from what Rob said in terms of team dynamics or just team composition?
Again, we don't have this currently in New Orleans, but we're talking about generating this. And one of the other things that we're looking for is in trauma cases and complicated trauma cases as well.
I think from my end, if your institution does do this, well, two things. If you're at a site that does this, one thing I'd recommend is every 3 to 4 months, it's probably worth doing some sort of multidisciplinary team training. Whether or not this is a mock patient in situ sim doesn't require a lot of necessarily simulation technology. All you need is a resuscitation dummy and the right people there. Because this is so team dependent, it's really important that your communication skills are effective. And with how big some of our departments can get, particularly emergency physician departments, it's important that we're all kind of on the same page when we're managing these patients together. So regular simulation, or at least some sort of open discussions about performing these types of resuscitations, are important. And then it's worth knowing, if you don't have this at your facility, if there are any in your area that do, I think a few centers are starting to create some referral services where they'll actually go to the site to initiate ECMO therapy. And so providing access to our patients, if maybe we're not in a tertiary quaternary care hospital, this technology is involved that really has the ability to save some lives that otherwise would have been lost. So getting to know your local referral centers and seeing that this is available as you're thinking about, is this right for my patient, is important.
Outstanding way to wrap things up, John. Couldn't agree with you more in terms of just the team dynamics, whoever that may be at your individual institutions, simulation, learning one another, what the needs are, and anticipating the next steps is essential in streamlining the implementation of this, as Rob and probably everyone would acknowledge, a very high intensity, high resource procedure. Well, I think that's going to do it for this podcast, guys. This was a great kickoff to 2019. Certainly a very critical therapy that's been talked about for a while. And as Peter reviewed, the indications for its use are continuing to emerge and expand. So very timely that we talked about it. Our thanks to Dr. Swole and his colleagues on an outstanding review article for the emergency physician published in Resuscitation. Certainly one of those must reads if you not only have a program, but are looking to develop an ECLS program. If you have any questions regarding any content that we discussed during this podcast, please shoot us an email. And once again, please be on the lookout in the coming weeks, coming months for a revamp and a new CCPEM website. We're going to be bringing back the CME option. That link is almost ready to go. So for those of you that need CME throughout the year and you're listening to the podcast, you will have that opportunity. This is Mike Winters once again for CCPEM from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore. Looking forward to talking to you on our next podcast. Bye for now.